Okay. So today we're going to talk about John and Charles Wesley. But before that, I want to give a word of context, maybe more context than you need, but to help us realize that what happened in England in the 17th century and in the 18th is much more upheaval as far as the church is concerned than we have ever experienced here at all. It's just, we might think we have got problems, but compared to that time, we have no problems. That's about the way you can look at it. So that caused lots of repercussions for how the church turned out. But let's just back up to about where we left off last time. You remember Elizabeth was the last surviving child of Henry VIII. And she inherited a divided kingdom, divided along religious lines, because her predecessor, her half-sister Mary, wanted the country to go back to Catholic, and she was in the process of doing that, including killing church leaders. And yet the movement to go Protestant had already been put in motion before that, and it was going pretty far. And so there are people on both sides now, and Elizabeth comes along trying to bring about some sort of peace, which she actually does a pretty good job with. Something called the Elizabethan settlement includes bringing back the prayer book that had been put together by under Edward VI, with some modifications to make things make the language a little bit less direct, maybe in some cases. The 39 Articles were brought back, pretty much the same as what they had been under Edward VI. And a book of homilies was published. Actually, it was published back with Edward VI and revised a bunch of times. And that's basically sermons that speak to some of the key points of the Reformation. So she's bringing back the Protestant movement, but she's not quite so enthusiastic about that as her half-brother Edward was. But nevertheless, it's a big movement from her sister Mary. There was still a lot of division, and notice these divisions aren't for the most part about doctrine. They're about other things, like what should the priests wear? And some of these things caused such heartburn that people left the church, even though you might say they're rather superficial. Ceremonies, for example, when you received the Lord's Supper, the Catholic tradition was to bow to kneel down to receive it, and some people thought they should still do that, and some people did not. But as my friend John Edwards said, if you bow down to receive the Lord's Supper, does that mean you have to think things the way the Catholics do? No. It's in your heart what you think. So whether you do that or not is doesn't make any difference. Like, another thing is, like, if the Pope sits down to pray, can you not sit down to pray? I mean, let's to get a little serious about what really matters. So church government was a bigger deal. Some people thought that the episcopal system was not healthy. Again, to quote John Edwards, the real problem with church government is not the form, it's the people. You can have good church government work under a congregational system, an episcopal system, a Presbyterian system, but you can also have it go bad under any one of those because of who the people are. And that was the point. So she wanted conformity on a lot of these minor issues. That's what Adio Fora is. And as a result of that, the country kind of divided into these four groups. There were some Puritans who stayed in the Church of England. They were the conformers. And some of them eventually left, not all at this time, but at some point later, which we'll talk about. So those are the three groups they kind of divided into, besides those who conformed. Do you have any questions about any of that? Now, Elizabeth didn't have any children, and so when she died, there was another succession problem. And this diagram is supposed to show how it worked. She was the daughter of Henry VIII, who is circled up there in the purple on the left side. James I, who came from Scotland, he was James VI in Scotland, was the great-great-grandson of Henry VII. So they are related. And that's the rationale that was used to have a peaceful transition, even though, of course, some people didn't think that it should have happened that way. But nevertheless, it was pretty peaceful. Any questions about that? So James came on the scene. He's a very strong believer in the divine right of kings, which means I'm the king. I'm accountable to God alone. I can do whatever I want. And, of course, that didn't go too well with what had happened centuries earlier with the Magna Carta and the beginning of Parliament and things like that. But he was very strong about that, wrote a book about it. The Gunpowder Plot is something that doesn't enter into American history very often, but if you know what happened, some Catholics tried to blow up the House of Lords on a day when the king and everybody else was going to be there. It was discovered there were 36 barrels of dynamite in the basement that were discovered, which a few years ago someone put together that amount of explosives in a building constructed like the House of Lords was and let it off. And boy, if anybody had been living in or alive in that building, they would have died. It just kind of blew everything to smithereens. So were the people a little bit paranoid about the Catholics? Well, yes, because things like this happened. This wasn't the first incident, nor the last. So that's why the country is really wary of any kind of Catholic influence. And some of these kings that came along were inclined that way. James is the one who brought about the King James Bible. Now, the King James Bible is notable because it was the English language Bible for hundreds of years without any essential change. Up until like the 20th century, that's what everybody spoke. In fact, if you're as old as I am, that's the Bible you used when you grew up. And even if you were, even people today think it's the only English version that's really inspired. I mean, they've gone that far. But the King James Bible did do amazing things for the English language, and a lot of figures of speech we have come right out of it. One of the reasons why he wanted this Bible is because the Geneva Bible, which had been popular before, had a lot of footnotes in it, which had theological explanations for how you should understand a certain verse. And that was favorable to a lot of the Puritans, but not to everybody. And so he wanted one that would be used by everyone. The Synod of Dort took place under his time, and if you know the story of that, this was an attempt to put down the people who had been supporting Arminius, who's the founder of Arminianism. Arminius and Arminianism aren't exactly the same any more than Calvin and Calvinists are the same, or Luther and Lutherans aren't all the same. But the Synod of Dort was an attempt by the Reformed Church in the Netherlands to respond to what the Arminian wing had proposed. Six men went from England to that synod and were significant additions to what happened there. And finally, the Book of Common Prayer was given a minor revision by James. And so he's basically doing things that are, I guess you'd say, helpful for the church in England at the time. Any questions about James I? His son, Charles I, married a Catholic woman from France, and she moved him toward a much more favorable position toward Catholics. And so along with William Laud, who became the Archbishop of Canterbury, the church is in form and a lot of background stuff moving more toward the Catholic Church. And by the way, when you see the word Arminianism in this context, it's a much broader term than we think of it today. Arminianism had to do with high church, with a very strong hierarchy. It wasn't just about predestination, which is how it's often thought of today. So under an Arminian view, the Archbishop of Canterbury really is the man in charge. He's like the Pope in the Roman Church. On the other hand, another group developed, which is goes by the name of Latitarianism, and this was low church. And these people wanted to be very tolerant of whatever you wanted to believe. The high church was, you've got to do it exactly this way. The low church didn't care so much how you did it. But they weren't, neither one of them was very good about how they interpreted the 39 articles. And so, in the case of the Latitudinarians, they could take the 39 articles and interpret them in lots of different ways. And that led to a lot of backlash, you might say, on the part of the Puritans, who were happy with the 39 articles, but they didn't want them misinterpreted. Let's see here. Part of the influence on the Latitudinarians was the Enlightenment, which brought in reason. So it's kind of like they were kind of saying, we know the Holy Spirit speaks to us, but we use our own reason. Of course, there's truth to that, but the extent to which you use your own reason to interpret things is what the problem is. A third group that came along were those that really weren't Christian in any sense. Deists, which, as you know, many of the American founders were deists, like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and some others. Herbert of Cherbury was one of the leaders in that movement in England. And basically, they believe that God created the world, and then after that, he hasn't really been too involved. And they don't believe in miracles or anything else that the Bible really teaches. John Locke was more of an Arian, and there's various varieties of Arianism. But that, and also the Socinians were basically Arians, but they came from a man named Socinius who was from Poland. So Arius's ideas about the fact that Jesus, they didn't believe Jesus was truly God, are floating around for a long time. Bishop Laud was arrested. He was arrested by Parliament because they could see he was moving in the wrong directions. And this is at the beginning of three successive civil wars. And the wars basically started, I think, because Charles I did not like Parliament interfering with what he wanted to do. He had his own agenda, and he wanted to move things in that direction. And he had to call Parliament once in a while because he couldn't raise taxes without them. No one would pay their taxes because that was the only official way to do it. So the wars developed as basically between King Charles and Parliament. And each one had their own army. And there were battles over that. And after a few years, Laud was convicted of high treason and executed. Now, why would you say he was accused of treason? Well, it's because his connection with the Roman Church. The Roman Church is about ready to blow us up, if they can. Not really the Church, not the Pope, but their agents. The people that are favorable toward Rome are trying to bring England back to the Catholic fold, however they can do it. And when Laud was tried, he basically said, you know, I didn't do anything. I'm just doing what the king wanted me to do. Of course, that's kind of in his case, it's a really interesting excuse because he was really the mastermind behind what was going on. But he completely denied any of it. But anyway, he was executed along with King Charles. Now, if the Parliament wing had not done such drastic things as to put people to death, there might not have been such a big backlash later on. But you know, when you have an action, there's often a reaction in politics as well as physics. So that's what happened. So you can see the whole country is really in a state of a bad state with all that's going on. Things are just not good. They're not healthy, and it's no wonder that things didn't move as smoothly forward as some people would have liked. So Oliver Cromwell becomes like the new dictator. He's on the parliament side, and I would say he probably was a good administrator for a while, but his son, who took over after he died, was not good. During this time, we also have the Westminster Assembly, which, of course, we refer to here because of the Confession of Faith and lots of other things. So why was that called? It was called because, not because the 39 Articles were not reformed, it was called because people were misinterpreting them. So the Westminster Assembly was called to be more explicit on what are we talking about here when we say God is sovereign, or whatever the issue was. And that's why it was called, and they met and produced those documents, which we have today. Have any questions about any of that? Yes?
So in other words, the Westminster Standard was not originally for ordaining people. There is that statement of faith.
Well, there's the Confession of Faith, and there's the catechisms. And we have put more, we've put more together with that, following that. Like we have a book of church order. Every Presbyterian church has, denomination has a book of church order. That wasn't part of that. But did I answer your question? I don't know.
Well, that's pretty much
it. So anyway, this is the kind of the foundation for the Presbyterian Church that was set up here on the English-speaking side. It's not the Reformed Church in the Netherlands, which used other documents like the Belgic Confession and Heidelberg, and they had three of them, actually. So when Charles is executed, his son, Charles II, he leaves as a refugee to France and stays there until after basically the parliamentary rule collapses and the people say, we want the king back. Now, Charles II actually told the Protestants that he would give them toleration. He'd let them worship their own way. Everything seemed like it was going the way it should. You have a freedom for your worship. You don't have to be following things exactly the way it happened before. But the people who were part of the Episcopal structure, who'd been shut out by the Puritans and the Presbyterians, they came back and they said, no, that's not going to happen. We're going to make you follow things exactly the way we say. And so even though the king came back with a welcome, what actually happened, as far as what he promised, did not happen. And that led to the great ejection of 1662 when nearly 2,000 ministers said, we cannot in good conscience follow what they're telling us to do, so they're gone. Not all the Puritans left, though, at the time. Some said, we can still function, and I don't know if they followed things exactly, but they stayed in the church. The Treaty of Dover, which was another important part of Charles II, was a secret treaty that he made with France. He told the French king that he would bring England back to the Catholic fold if he would give him military aid against the Dutch. So here we see there's still trouble with the Catholic Church. And Charles II is not helping the situation. And that was discovered. And then he died, and his son took over. He continued to try to move the church toward Rome. And because of people's suspicions about that, they were trying to figure out what to do. And What they ended up doing was getting Mary, who was the let me not get too far ahead of myself here. Mary was his daughter, James II's daughter. Yes?
I think James II is the brother of Charles.
I'm sorry?
James II is actually Charles II's brother.
Yeah, that's right. You're right. You're right. Yes.
Legitimate.
Yes.
Offspring.
Yep. You're right. Thank you for telling me that. James II was Charles II's brother. He was Charles I's son. James II was moving the country back toward the Catholic Church, and he had two daughters. One, the oldest, was Mary, and she was married to a Dutchman, William of Orange. And so, behind the scenes, people decided maybe we could replace James II with Mary I. And that's what they did. And so William assembled a huge invading force, which included 40,000 troops and 400 ships, and kind of brought them out in the open so they could be seen. And the French decided maybe we don't want to support this guy. After a while, he's losing support, and so they don't help him. And so James basically flees to the continent, and Parliament declares that he's abdicated. So they welcome William and Mary to replace them. And that is called the Glorious Revolution, because William and Mary are Protestant, and they figure that that's the end of it. It wasn't quite the end of it, but it was the beginning of a more tolerant view, and William brought in the Act of Toleration, which is basically giving freedom of worship to all Protestants, which hadn't happened before. So there were restrictions on Protestant worship, and there were restrictions on, for example, you couldn't be an official in the government without being a member of the church and things like that. But there was still an attempt on his life by supporters of former King James II. It didn't succeed, but you can see the country still isn't free of the problem. The Act of Settlement was under William III, and he was trying to figure out what to do for the next problem of succession. William and Mary never had any children that survived, and so they passed a law that said the future king or queen of England is going to be Protestant. We're not going to allow a Catholic to come back into this, which means that when somebody dies without a child to succeed them, they've got to go back up the chain of heredity and figure out who it is that can be in that position, just like it happened with James I and Elizabeth. It also said that the king would be the leader of the church. And that's something that's continued on to this day. If you know, when Henry VIII said he was head of the church, it didn't really follow that his successor in the monarchy would be. And so this establishes that as well. After Mary died, her sister Anne became the queen. She married a Lutheran Dane, but after 17 pregnancies, nobody survived. So she was succeeded by a cousin who was German, and this goes way, way back in the succession, but it survived. It was a peaceful thing. This man couldn't speak English very well, but he was Protestant, and that was more important than whether he could speak English. So from this time on, the trouble between the church and state basically is diminished, and the trouble with the Catholic Church fades away. And so things become much more peaceful. But you can see the 17th century and into the 18th was a lot of trouble. Any questions about any of that?
How many pregnancies did she have?
17.
And no one survived? They all died?
Well, some of them were stillbirths, but yeah. So the other part of this context is the Pietist movement. Now, when England was having all this trouble, there was also trouble in Germany. The trouble then was the 30 Years' War. And this 30 Years' War basically was Protestant versus Catholic. And it was so severe that the population of what was then Germany went from 21 million down to 13 million. If you can imagine that, more than a third of the population died as a result of this war. It wasn't all someone getting shot. There's also disease. But nevertheless, it was a huge hit on the country. And there's actually some amazing hymns that come out of that period to show what really matters. The Peace of Westphalia was finally signed, and that really didn't change things from how they were before, for the most part, which was namely was, if the leader of your a political leader of your region, whether it's a province or whatever you want to call it, is Protestant, you're Protestant. If he's Catholic, you're Catholic. So the leader is determining the religion of his people. But because of all this, the German Lutherans weren't really functioning as a healthy church. There was all the chaos, all the death. I mean, you can imagine there's being people having funerals all the time. And there's also trouble between Lutherans and Calvinists over what is the right direction for the Protestant church. And so because of that, the church was declining from what it should be. A few of these people, though, were influenced by some of the Puritans in England, and that helped the situation to some extent. Here's one of the people that it helped. Philip Jacob Spener was an educated man, as you can see here. He was a pastor, and he helped bring back an important element of what it means to be a Christian into the Lutheran Church at the time, which is known as Pietism, which I'll describe here in a minute. He's actually called the father of Pietism, and he helped reform what was going on there. And as you can see in this book he published, which is called The Piety We All Desire, it emphasized a more important, the more extensive use of God's Word, the new birth conversion. You know, the church in Rome didn't really emphasize what it means to be born again. That was not part of their theology or their preaching. Now, of course, Luther understood that, but he's long gone, and it sort of faded from the Lutheran church as well. He emphasized that we're all priests in God's kingdom. He emphasized private Bible study, small group Bible study, to understand what it means to live by faith. What does it mean for me as a Christian to live in my community? How do I help the poor? Look at what Jesus did. Are we doing that? Well, they really weren't to a large extent. And he also was concerned about how ministers would be educated. If you don't have a good education, our ministers, I mean, they're the ones that preach the gospel. If the people in the churches are going astray, you have to ask the question, what is happening from the pulpit? And so he put together this book, which is basically trying to reform the Lutheran church, which had become kind of dead and stale to a large extent. Some people thought he was becoming too subjective, too anti-intellectual. Some people thought they should just leave Lutheran Church. So not everybody was happy with what he said, but it was a movement that took off and actually had a big influence all over Germany and into England. Here's an important element of what he was teaching that I think we often lose sight of. The Reformation talked about justification, which is certainly true and certainly important. But he was emphasizing regeneration. What does it mean to be born again? You can think of justification as something that's objective. It's true. It's critical. It's central. But if your life isn't changed, that's just an abstract idea. It certainly applies to us, and Luther understood that. But a lot of people could teach that without really getting straight what it means for us. And so to be born again, which is what regeneration is, means I become spiritually alive. And this was an emphasis of the Pietist movement, more so than justification was. They also emphasized that when I take the Lord's Supper, it's personal, it's my relationship to God. It's not just abstract grace coming in some way. That's objectively true, but think about it as a personal experience. So this is the Pietist movement that's coming alive to revive the church in Germany and across Europe. And you notice here there's 284 doctrinal errors that he was accused of by the University of Wittenberg. Now, I don't know what those are. I never looked them up. But people can always find fault with what you're doing. I think this is probably really picky. But for the most part, what Spener did was healthy and good and a blessing. He was succeeded by a man named Franke, who was one of his students for a while, and he taught many future pastors and missionaries along these lines. He did things to help the church move out to the community in lots of ways. You can see this long list here. All kinds of things were done that you might say, this is what Jesus would have me do, to reach out to people who are poor or needed the gospel. A third man to mention here is Zinzendorf, who was his student and became a leader of the Moravian Church. And the Moravian Church is what figures into our story with the Wesleys. And by the way, Zinzendorf wrote hymns, like I think in our church hymnal we have Jesus, Thy Blood and Righteousness, and maybe some others, I don't know. But as far as I can tell, the Moravian movement at this time sent out more missionaries for how big they were than any other Christian group in history. I might be wrong about that, but it's substantial what they did. They went all over. The Catholic Church sent lots of missionaries, but they were big. This group was small. This man had a huge estate, and people could come to his estate and get trained. They could come there and escape persecution from nearby people. And eventually this man's witness led to the conversion of the Wesleys. Any questions about that?
Can I actually go back a little bit? I'm kind of curious. I think the Catholic Church, when they would do reaching out outside the church and ministry, it was often done through the different orders. Is that correct?
That's right.
Was this where we started having parachurch organizations initialized, or were these done within the church still?
This is pretty much still within the church, although there are groups that split off from this. Like the Mennonite Brethren and people like that, they become separate denominations. Okay. But as far as parachurch organizations, I don't really think that's happening yet.
At this point. Okay.
But I could be wrong, but I don't think so. So another man to mention here is Bengel, who was also influential in John Wesley's understanding. And then Muhlenberg. I don't know if you know the name Muhlenberg, but there's Muhlenberg College, named after this guy, back in Indiana or Ohio or someplace back there. Today, the Moravians, I think, though, have declined in their vitality. They've produced lots of good music, but I think the spiritual state of the Moravians isn't so great these days. So now we move on to the Wesleys and their friend George Whitfield. Just to begin with, Samuel and Susanna Wesley were the parents of John and Charles. And Samuel's father was a nonconformist minister. In other words, he left the Church of England and was a pastor separate when it was not always so legal. But Samuel, John's father, went back into the Church of England, and actually he was high church and very strong on the Church of England. His two sons were also, for that matter. Susanna is an amazing woman for what she did. For one thing, she had 19 children, which probably exceeds the number of children maybe almost of every woman in this room together. If you add them all up, I don't know. But that was a lot. And Charles was number 15, and I'm sorry, John was 15, and Charles was number 18. She helped them get educated so they can be prepared to go to the university. She had them memorize portions of the Bible. She was really an amazing person to pull all this off with so many kids. I mean, it's hard to even believe, but she should not be overlooked. John was rescued from a fire of the parsonage when he was 5 years old. And he was rescued by having one man stand on another man's shoulder and reach up and grab him. Otherwise, he would have perished. The rest of the family got out, but he didn't. He went on to Oxford and earned his degrees. He became a deacon and priest in the Church of England and also became a missionary. All of that happened before he understood what it means to be saved. His brother Charles was a little bit behind him. He also went through the same process and with his brother started something called the Holy Club. And if you can see what they did here, they were pretty strict in their the process they were following. They were so strict that they were called Methodists and other things. The Holy Club, that wasn't their name. That's what other students called them, tried to mock them and shame them because they were so serious. But they were serious. In fact, they were so serious that I believe it was George or Charles, one of them kind of got ill from being under such a strict schedule for so long. They went to missionary to Georgia as missionaries, I think I said, and it turned out not to be a good trip for them for various reasons, which I won't go into. But one thing that happened was on the way there was a big storm. The storm caused the main mast of the ship to break, and while that happened, the people from England who were there were in a panic, screaming and making lots of ruckus. And meanwhile, there's this other group of people who had been singing during this storm, and they acted like nothing happened. These were the Moravians. So John saw these people and thought, what's going on with these people? And after the ship landed in Georgia, he was introduced to this man named Spangenberg. And here's a record of the conversation he had with him. Spangenberg said, "My brother, I must first ask you one or two questions. Have you the witness within yourself? Does the Spirit of God bear witness with your spirit that you are a child of God?" Wesley says, "I was surprised and knew not what to answer." He observed it and asked, "Do you know Jesus Christ?" I paused and said, "I know he is the Savior of the world." Turi replied, "But do you know he has saved you?" I answered, "I hope he has died to save me." He only added, "Do you know yourself?" I said, "I do, but I fear they were vain words." Wesley hadn't figured out what was going on at this point in his life. His brother Charles and him both met another Moravian back in England. Now, if you see the dates here, this is a little more than 2 years after their time in Georgia. They didn't even, I don't think they even stayed a year there. It was not, it didn't work out very well. But well, at one point Charles was ill and a friend brought him a copy of Luther's commentary on Galatians. And here is a conversation that this man recorded a few days later, on May 21st. Mr. Charles Wesley read the preface aloud at the words, "What have we then nothing to do? No, nothing but only accept him, who of God is made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption." I think that comes from 1 Corinthians. "There came such a power over me as I cannot well describe. My great burden fell off, and in an instant my heart was so filled with peace and love that I burst into tears. I almost thought I saw our Savior. My companions, perceiving me so affected, fell on their knees and prayed. When I afterwards went out into the streets, I could scarcely feel the ground I trod upon." That's Charles Wesley's, it's his friend's record of what Charles Wesley experienced. A few days later, John was at a service at Aldersgate, which he recorded in his diary. "In the evening, I went very unwillingly to a society in Aldersgate Street, where one was reading Luther's preface to the Epistle to the Romans. About a quarter before nine, while he was describing the change which God works in the heart through faith in Christ, I felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ, Christ alone, for salvation. And an assurance was given me that he had taken away my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death." So right there, in a few short days, both John and Charles experienced a new birth. It's an amazing change in their lives.
I have a question, Dan.
Yeah, sure.
So, chronologically, where does this fit in with the Holy Club? So were they had the Holy Club before they...
They had the Holy Club when they were at Oxford. Actually, John had graduated, but he came back and participated in it. And George Whitfield, who was younger than both of them, was a student when it was going on.
Okay.
So, yeah, they're in the Holy Club. They're seeking. They're really seeking seriously.
But it's just an outward.
But they did not understand from what they'd been taught. It was like...
Yeah, okay.
So, right after this, we have the... let's talk about George Whitfield first. He was a few years behind them. He actually became a Christian before he graduated. Well, he was a student. So he became a believer before both of them. And he was then ordained a deacon and a priest in the church. And then he also went to the colonies as a missionary. But he actually stayed. He went back and forth seven times. He was part of what became known as the Great Awakening. And probably maybe the main person in that whole movement, because he started doing outdoor preaching before both of them, and that's what he did mainly in America. And I don't know if you know the story, but Benjamin Franklin, who encountered him, was very interested in his method of preaching and what he had to say. He wasn't ever persuaded to actually believe, but he attended a number of Whitfield's sermons, and he actually one time wrote down that he calculated that Wesley could speak so loudly that people could hear him at such a distance that Franklin estimated that 30,000 people could hear him preach, which if you can think about that today, that's amazing. 30,000 people. Whitfield did not live as long as John Wesley, but Whitfield did preach, by people's estimate, 18,000 sermons to probably more than 10 million people, which at the time probably was, there was no one who exceeded that. Wesley actually gave something like 40,000 sermons. He traveled on horseback all over England. They estimate about 250,000 miles of horseback riding, but he preached to smaller groups. So how many he preached to, no one's given an estimate so far. Also, will tell you that on one of his voyages to the colonies, Whitfield realized that his Arminian theology was not as biblical as he originally thought, and so he split from the Wesleys over that. They still were friends, and actually Whitfield wrote John a letter and tried to persuade him to read some things that might change his mind, but he never did. So the Wesleyan Methodists, as we might call them, were in two groups. Some of them were following John Wesley, adopting a lot of these Moravian ideas, which had been taught to them by the Moravians. And eventually, the church split from the Church of England and the Episcopal Church in this country to be a separate denomination. Wesley was not about to change denominations. He was going to stay in the Church of England, and he did until he died. But a few years after he died, they separated. So that was 1795 when that happened. And in the U.S., it began as the Methodist Episcopal Church. But the other side of that was a group called the Calvinistic Methodists. Now, they were still following some of the Methodist practices, but they adopted a more Reformed theology and were primarily Welsh. And this is the group that George Whitfield sort of joined. And they eventually became the Presbyterian Church of Wales in 1923, which is sort of interesting. Both of them saw themselves not as reforming the church, but as reviving it. So you see the word change from Reformation back in the 16th century to now it's revival, to sort of bring life back, not to really change the doctrines, but to bring life back. And even before the split in England, they constructed what we would call a church, but they called them preaching houses because they didn't want to identify as starting a new church. But the Methodists built hundreds of these in England before the split actually occurred. So, quickly, why was this a turning point? First of all, it brought these doctrines of the Reformation back into people's thinking as how they affected them. And the doctrines, of course, of the Reformation affect each one of us. But if you think of it as just something over there and you ignore, it doesn't affect you at all. And a lot of the preaching had ignored that. They ignored what the 39 Articles said, and they were preaching social gospel or whatever they felt like preaching. They also started to focus on evangelizing the working and poor people. The one problem with the church hierarchy was that the bishops felt, well, you know, we've got to connect with the upper class people. And they basically ignored the working people because, you know, they're dirty and they're uneducated and I'd rather associate with the people in the golf course, right? That's how the church bishops often were. Also from this movement came the idea that we can all be in different denominations and still be at peace. And that was kind of important. The Church of England tried to say we can only have one church and that's it. But now with the Methodist Church, we have more pluralism, if you will. Also, the laity became more active in Bible study and interpretation. Before that, it was just the clergy that were actually studying the Bible and teaching it. And with the Moravian movement, the Pietist movement, Bible study becomes something that we all can do. And again, it's not just following tradition, it's following things that happen to each one of us as individuals, our own personal experience with God. And of course, that's how we often can reach people. Because if someone's got a problem that you've had, you can talk to them. I think this might be the end of my note. No, one more. They were also a significant part of the evangelical movement, which historically includes these four elements: the Bible, the cross, conversion, and evangelism in a full sense of that word. So that's the end of today. Do you have any questions? I'm sorry about the notes, but hopefully the machine will get working before next week, and I'll bring you some next week. Thank you.